Hello and welcome to this IASB board meeting podcast summary. Board meeting of the 19th to 21st of November 2012. My name is Mark Byatt. I'm joined by Steve Cooper, a member of the IASB, and Sue Lloyd, Senior Director of Technical Activities. Steve, perhaps we could start with you, if you could bring us up to date on the discussions regarding revenue recognition.
Yeah, this is the continuing redeliberations of the revenue recognition exposure draft. We're getting towards the end of these topics now. But there were three things that we did at this meeting. Firstly, constraining the amount of revenue that's recognised. Then we talked about collectability and then licences. Particularly the first two are things that we've already been having some discussions on previously. Anyway, talking about the constraint. This is in situations where there's uncertainty about the amount of revenue. So it's where you have variable consideration, bonuses, penalties, and the like as part of the consideration amount for a contract. And the whole issue has been how to measure the consideration under those circumstances and then whether one should constrain the amount of revenue that's recognized until these uncertainties are resolved. So we discussed two things within this. One is where the constraint should be located, because as you know, within our five-step model, there are two places that you could have the constraint. Step three, in measuring the transaction price, you could exclude this uncertain part of the transaction price at that point, or you could include it in the transaction price and measure the transaction price of the most likely or the probability weighted amount. And then when you come to step five, which is recognizing revenue, as you satisfy a performance obligation, you could recognize less than the full amount at that point. Anyway, we decided that we would put the constraint in step three. I think the staff were of the view that it doesn't actually matter which step it's in, and it's something that perhaps is best done within the drafting process, but we tend to have decided to put it in step three. And then the staff will assess whether that works or not when it comes to actually sort of clearly drafting the requirements. Perhaps more importantly, though, the application of the requirement itself, and this was all to do with when the constraint should kick in and how you should constrain the amount of revenue, under what circumstances would you not recognize the full amount of the transaction price. And this has been subject to a lot of debate concerning the amount of uncertainty. What is it about the uncertain amount that would cause you to apply the constraint? Anyway, the board decided that the amount of revenue we recognize should be an amount that is not subject to significant revenue reversals, that is to say, any downward adjustment that might arise from subsequent changes in the estimate of the amount of variable consideration to which the entity is entitled. So I think that sort of gives a very clear objective as to what the constraint is. We go on to emphasize that this is a qualitative constraint and we don't have a particular confidence level in mind. But nevertheless, our intention is that the level of confidence would need to be relatively high, that there wouldn't be a reversal, as I said, in order to recognize revenue. Anyway, we will be providing guidance and examples within the document to clarify that. Second issue was collectability, and this is particularly the presentation of bad debt expenses, to put it simply. What we decided is we would confirm the proposal in the 2011 ED that we should actually recognise revenue at the amount the entity is entitled to, that is before taking into account the collectability, at least for transactions for which there is not a significant financing component, and that we would however, present the impairment losses that arise from these contracts with customers prominently as an expense in the statement of comprehensive income, which is a change from the ED where we have proposed to locate it immediately below the revenue line. So we've reverted to something closer to existing practice in that area. And then lastly, licenses. The whole issue here is when an entity grants a license, has it performed at the point of granting the license and therefore revenue is recognized at that point in time? Or should revenue be recognized over the period of the license on the basis that performance is continuous during that period? Anyway, we've decided on the appropriate basis on which we do that split. Not all licenses will be reported point in time. the entity should consider the characteristics of the license, and you'll see within update that there are a number of characteristics which are identified, which an entity would use to make that decision about the pattern of revenue recognition. I won't read out what those characteristics are, but they're all listed within update itself.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Sue, perhaps we could come on to financial instruments now, particular reference to impairment.
Okay, thanks, Mark. It was an important impairment meeting last week. The staff were following up on a request from the board at the last meeting to come back with some suggestions for how we could respond to the feedback that we'd received from constituents on our three-bucket model during our recent outreach. And for those of you who haven't been watching the project, the feedback we'd got was that most of our constituents agreed that the approach that the board is looking at with the so-called three-bucket model is to recognise an allowance based on a 12-month measure until assets deteriorate sufficiently, at which point in time a lifetime expected loss allowance would be established. And people had told us that they agreed with making a distinction between assets that had deteriorated and those that hadn't, but they were confused about when deterioration was considered to have occurred, and in particular we were asked questions about how it would apply to retail assets. The board decided to simplify the criteria in response to this feedback. And in particular, they agreed that there'd be one criteria used to determine when you would move to a lifetime expected loss measure, and that would occur when there'd been significant deterioration in credit quality since the initial recognition of an asset. And the type of information that the board agreed you could look at would be if you would have priced an asset differently as a result of the increase in credit risk that had occurred since it was first originated. The board decided that in relation to high quality assets, to simplify the application of the deterioration concept, it would be acknowledged that while an asset was still investment grade, that it wouldn't be considered to have deteriorated to a point where you'd need to measure lifetime expected losses. So if you've got very high quality assets above investment grade, you don't need to think about moving to a lifetime measure until they've deteriorated to below investment grade. In response to the feedback that the board had got about particularly retail portfolios where there may not be updated borrower-specific credit information available, the board explicitly acknowledged that in those situations, entities could use delinquency information as the basis for assessing whether or not a deterioration had occurred. And so the document will acknowledge that as a rebuttable presumption, if an asset is at least 1 month past due, then a lifetime expected allowance should be recognised, and that will be a rebuttable presumption. So the board thinks that with those simplifications, we will have addressed a lot of the concerns raised during our outreach. The final thing that the board looked at on impairment at this meeting was disclosure requirements, particularly for non-financial institutions. And the board acknowledged that we'd already provided a simplification in the model, that if you have trade receivables and lease receivables, an entity need not make a distinction between assets that have deteriorated and those that have not. So it's already a simplified model. And consistent with that simplified model, the board agreed to simplified disclosures for entities who have trade receivables and lease receivable assets. So that basically completed the decision making on the impairment project, which is why I said it was an important discussion. And so at the December meeting, we expect the staff to bring papers back to the board to confirm the completion of due process requirements and to agree the comment period for the document. And it was indicated that we expect the exposure draft on the three-bucket model to be published in the first quarter of 2013.
Okay, thanks, Sue. Steve, if we could come back to you to provide an update on insurance contracts.
Yeah, continuing deliberations on insurance. The first issue that we discussed was a discount rate question. This is the discount rate that should apply to those contracts where there is a link to asset returns but not a contractual link. If there's a contractual link, then we have the so-called mirroring approach, but if there's not that contractual link, then there's a question of to what extent the asset returns should be taken into account in setting the discount rate for the liability. Given the linkage that is present, we decided that the discount rate should reflect the extent to which the estimated cash flows are affected by the return on those assets, and we shouldn't use the same discount rate that would be applied, for example, in a non-participating type of contract where there isn't that linkage into asset returns. Second issue we discussed was presentation. Presentation of both the balance sheet and statement of comprehensive income. For the balance sheet, we decided that an entity should be required to present separate line items for insurance contracts and reinsurance contracts, this, on the face of the balance sheet, could combine the two different approaches that we have, the premium allocation approach and the building block approach, but that there would obviously be disaggregation of these things within the notes. In terms of the income statement, we decided that IAS 1, that governs the presentation of financial statements, is sufficient to deal with insurance contracts, particularly now that we've moved to an earned premium presentation approach for the building block approach. That now lines up with the premium allocation approach, and it produces a format of presentation for insurance contracts which is essentially the same as for any revenue income generating situation in other industries, and therefore we believe that the requirements in IAS 1 are sufficient to give guidance on how to present insurance contracts within the statement of comprehensive income. Then lastly, we went on to talk about a number of the disclosure requirements, particularly disclosure requirements in terms of participating contracts, the disclosure requirements for the presentation of earned premiums, and how we might disaggregate information about earned premiums. I'm not going to go through the detail here. There's, I think, two or three pages of listing all the disclosure requirements within Update, and people can go through the detail if they so wish. One thing I would like to point out, though, is that many people have said about not losing information that they currently have, and particularly about having different types of information about, particularly volume, about the performance of an entity. We've gone for an earned premium type presentation on the statement of comprehensive income. However, the disclosure requirements that we're proposing will involve not just a disaggregation of the components of an earned premium, but also information, for example, about premiums written and premiums received, so that people can look at different types of volume information, not just the one that happens to appear in the statement of comprehensive income. Anyway, as I say, there's a list of the various disclosures that we considered and decided on within Update itself. And one final thing, and that is that as part of the re-exposure process, we do plan clearly a lot of extensive outreach that will go ahead, but in particular we have plans for some field work that will take place where we're obtaining input directly from companies, getting companies to apply some of the proposals in real life situations. The idea is to understand better how the targeted proposals will be applied in practice. In particular, we want to use this field work to evaluate the costs and benefits of those proposals, and also assess how the proposed approach would help insurers communicate with users of their financial statements. I think this is very important. At the moment, many people talk to us that insurance accounting is something of a black box and you need to be a particular specialist expert to really try and identify what's going on, and even then it's difficult. One of the whole objectives of this project is to try and make insurance, the accounting for insurance contracts, more transparent, easier to understand. So that's one thing that we'll be particularly trying to test within this fieldwork exercise. So the staff presented us with various proposals as to how they're going to go about this and their plans for the coming months.
Okay, thanks Steve. Sue, perhaps we can come back to you just to tidy up any loose ends that were discussed during the meeting.
Okay, thanks. We did have an education session where the board had the first discussion on the conceptual framework project. No decisions were made, but there was a discussion which will be continued, I believe, at the December meeting. In addition, we had some external participants who came and provided the board with an education session. They presented the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force report. The Enhanced Disclosure Task Force is a committee that was formed by the Financial Stability Board earlier this year, and they provided us with an overview of the recommendations that are included in their report, which was interesting background for the board, particularly in the context of disclosure and the conceptual framework, and also the board's upcoming discussion forum on disclosures, which will be held early next year. I guess the other thing, which isn't specific to the board meeting, Mark, but it's probably of interest to people, to those listening to the podcast, is that we expect to publish the exposure draft on the limited amendments to IFRS 9's classification and measurement requirements later this week.
Okay. Steve, thank you very much for your time. That just leaves me to provide the obligatory health warning that these are the personal views of the presenters and may or may not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The official summary of the board meeting is provided by IASB Update, which is available to download from the IASB website. Thank you.